May it please the court, the facts in this case are relatively simple, really, and the law, the applicable law, really is not that difficult either. This involves a dispute, of course, as to a settlement that occurred.
Can you speak into the mic a little bit?
I'm sorry, Judge. Usually I speak too loud, so try to speak lower. But the facts of this case, as I said, deal with an accident that occurred on October the 2nd of 2009. And in that accident, there were four people that were injured. Two were minors and two were adults. One of the policy limits of the tort fees was $1,530. One of the adults settled for $15,000 early on, and he's not involved in this case at all. The other three individuals, of course, that would have had $15,000 left, but the insurance company decided that they would offer the full coverage of $30,000, even though they only already paid $15,000. Which is extremely rare and is done only when it's pretty clear that the injuries are such that the adjuster was acting in bad faith in giving out the half of its coverage. In any event, in this case, Mr. Nietzsche represented the Barlows, which is a mother and a husband who had lost a consortium claim, and also the child, a minor, named John Barlow. And he filed suit in April of 2011, but he also included in the lawsuit my client, Kimberly Fought, or Dawn Locke, the mother of Kimberly Fought. And of course, I don't know to this day whether my client knew that she was even included in the suit or not, but in any event, she retained us on September the 8th of 2011, which would have been just less than a month before the statute expired, and 6 days later, on September 14th, we filed suit on her behalf. And after filing suit on her behalf, around a few days later, we were contacted by the Titan's insurance attorney, who had indicated that Titan was offering the full amount of the $30,000. And in the discussion indicated that the minor's injuries were about the same. And he basically said, and he wrote a letter also to that effect, which may or may not be part of the record, but he indicated that we should try to work it out between ourselves as to how to divide the $30,000. He had indicated that one of the people that was represented by Mr. Nietzsche, which turned out to be which was the mother, the adult, had some serious injuries. And so eventually we agreed that, or relying on that the injuries were about the same, I agreed to give that the mother could get 15 and the remaining 15 could be divided between the two minors. And I did that because, as I said, that I relied on that. But at that point in time, I had not really discussed it with my client. When the time came that we had to prepare for a petition and so forth and whatever needed to be done, since there were minors, and I talked to my client and told her that what I was proposing was that they would divide the $15,000 because the injury was about the same, is what, of course, she informed me that the young Barlow, wasn't injured at all. He went she didn't know exactly what the treatment had been, but she knew that he was not injured at all. It turns out, of course, that he only went to the emergency room and that was it. And my client was sort of like aghast that somebody would say something differently. And in any event, so I basically contacted Mr. Nietzsche and said, my client says that he was not injured, and I can't proceed with this without getting medical records to justify this. And the medical records, of course, indicated that he only went to the hospital and that was it. My client was not willing to go along with the settlement. If things had gone the way they would have gone normally, the case would have gone to a judge for approval of a minor settlement, and she would have stood, taken the stand and said, I don't think this is fair. I don't agree with this. And the judge would generally have said, fine, then if you don't agree, then we're not going to allow the settlement to proceed.
It's been a few years since I was on Chancery, and this jurisdiction for the minor settlement and a personal injury action was transferred from Chancery to Superior Court. Your last comment makes me wonder, has the procedure changed? Because whether or not the parties agreed to settle or not in any particular amount, there still has to be an approval by the court that as it in respect to each of the minors, the settlement was fair and reasonable. It just doesn't happen to result in a final order based on the fact the parties say they've settled. Has that changed?
Not at all, Your Honor. It's exactly the same.
Well, that didn't happen here, did it?
No, it did not.
Why not?
What happened is that when there was a motion to enforce filed by Mr. Nietzsche, Judge, even though our defense was there was no authority, you don't have the right to do this because it's a minor, we need to go to have the court of a hearing. In addition to that, there was interpleader filing where Titan filed an interpleader action saying to the court, you decide how to divide this money because we were disputing about dividing it. In spite of all that, Judge Parkin said, I'm going to enforce the settlement because there's, quote, presumed authority for an attorney, even though I made it clear I did not have authority.
I'm sorry, Judge Parkins did appear to recognize that a fairness hearing was required, didn't he?
No, Your Honor, not really, because, you see, what...
Well, didn't he so order in his final order?
No, not in his final order. He did not order at all. In his first order, verbally he said that he was going to refer to the, he was going to have a hearing on the petition for approval. But two problems. First time he did it twice. He also did issue another order later on saying that the commissioner would have a hearing on whether to approve the settlement. There were two problems with this. The problem is that, first of all, the judge himself, if Judge Parkins did it, certainly not going to reverse himself. He's already said that he's going to uphold or enforce this even split. He would have to reverse himself. Certainly, if he went to the commissioner wasn't going to do it. But it's even a worse problem because, remember, generally what you do is you go in front of the court and you say, they're offering $7,500. The client gets up and says, yes, I think it's okay. You know, I'm willing to go. My attorney recommends it, so forth and so on. And the court approves or doesn't approve it. But in this case, there are two people, and there's $15,000. Certainly, if Mr. Barlow and Mr. Nietzsche had gone there, Mr. Nietzsche actually filed a petition to have a hearing that was noticed for March the 9th, a week after the decision upholding this settlement. But the judge to this date has not heard it, and it's not because the appeal is pending, because the appeal didn't occur for a year later, whatever it was. But the problem is that if Mr. Barlow had gone there, whether it was a commissioner or a judge or somebody else, they certainly would have said, sure, this settlement's fine. I mean, $7,500 for an office visit, for an emergency room, it's fine. Now, once he does that, see, the two were not heard together necessarily.
I think what you're saying is there should have been an evidentiary hearing on the fairness of the settlement, whether it was conducted by Judge Tolliver, who I understand had the case in chief, or whether it was done by Judge Parkins. Is that right?
And the only way it would have worked is if we had it together so that the court, so that the commissioner or judge could say, this is how we're going to divide this money, because this is not a settlement where somebody offers you something, you know, individual.
Well, if Judge Tolliver, for example, had held an evidentiary hearing on the fairness of the settlement as far as the minors were concerned.
Right.
If there has been no hearing to determine whether the settlement is fair and reasonable as it purports to apply to each of the minors, where is the final order that makes this appealable to us?
Oh, the final order that Judge Parkins entered. He said it was a final order.
I don't care what he said about it being a final order. The question is, how can it be if he didn't conduct the hearing he's required to conduct.
Well, this is part of my appeal. My appeal is that it should be reversed and sent back at least for a hearing, or at least for determination whether there was authority, whether a settlement is binding, and then after that to see what is fair and reasonable.
Right.
So there's two arguments.
So
here,
if there had been a hearing on whether it was fair and reasonable, and the trial judge, whoever it was, had found that the split, $15,000 on the one end, and then the two others getting $7,500 was fair, then there would be no need for a second hearing of any kind, correct? I mean, that would be the sole...
No, because we're skipping over one thing here. We're skipping over whether you're going to enforce the settlement with that authority. If we're going to enforce with that authority, if that's fine, then we get the second step of having a hearing. But if you're going to have a hearing, it's got to be a joint hearing.
There was an adult. How many adults were involved in the case?
Two altogether, but one is not involved. Well, two are not. The adults are not involved in this, really, because they got their $15,000 each. What's left is $15,000.
Only adults in the case, then we wouldn't be worried about the minor.
Right.
But there was a minor.
Two minors.
Your point is that the fairness of the proposed settlement as far as the two minors were concerned should have been determined before there was a hearing that implicated the adult. That is, the first hearing should have established what percentage of the $30,000 would have been fair to the minors. Is that your point?
That certainly is one way of doing it, and that certainly would have been a better way to do it. But even if you don't do that, and you say, okay, well, there's $15,000 left, and at the very least, there should be a hearing on whether how to divide this $15,000 that you could do in a... There was actually a petition interpleader filed which would have required that hearing, but Judge Parkins ignored. But Judge Parkins' final order, it says final judgment, says, here it is, directed for time to pay the money out, and dismissed the case. And that was it. And actually, frankly, ignored the fact that we were still dealing with the defendants that were never dealt with. So,
You're into your rebuttal time. Did you want to save it?
I can save it, Your Honor. Thank you.
May it please the Court. Good afternoon. I just want to focus a little bit more on the settlement history, if I could, for the Court to understand. In the appendix, the settlement discussion started by Mr. Leone writing a letter to both of us saying that there's $15,000 essentially to divide up among the two minors. Mr. Ramuno then wrote a letter to me, September 23rd, which is a B9 in the exhibits, that essentially said, how about if we divide the money up $10,000 apiece? That is $10,000 to my adult plaintiff, $10,000 to my minor plaintiff, and $10,000 to his minor plaintiff. And he carbon copied his client on that letter. Obviously, he would have to have the authority to do that. And another letter was written by him, again, proposing the 10, 10, and 10.
Why is this relevant to what we're supposed to decide?
Because I think what Judge Parkins decided was that because, and I'm not speaking for him, I'm trying to understand his ruling. I think what he said was because there was authority that was given, and because Mr. Ramuno had accepted the settlement, and because that settlement is a final, that authority bound his client, and any remedy that his client might have maybe, because again, I think the court realized that he was willing to take 10.
Final in what sense, other than that's what the parties proposed to be the settlement?
Well, I would agree with Your Honor.
How can it be final beyond that?
Well, because we have a final order from Judge Parkins.
I'm not talking about what the order says. I'm talking about what, as a matter of law, should have happened. How can you have a final settlement involving minors when there hasn't been a hearing to determine whether, in respect to each of the minors, the settlement proposed for each of them is fair and reasonable?
Well, I think what Judge Parkins said was because there was this settlement discussion, and the settlement discussion was finalized, and time went by, that his opinion was that that settlement is binding, even though there's a minor.
I understand he said that. My question is, how can he do that consistently with the law?
Well, my understanding, Your Honor, is what I did was, after that ruling, we filed a motion to have a minor settlement approved. Mr. Amuno never did that, and he may not have thought he needed to do that, but what has occurred since then, frankly, is that he has dispersed his money to his minor plaintiff.
Let's back up for a moment.
Yes, sir.
Suppose then there was a hearing after Judge Parkins ruled to focus on the fairness to the minors. Wouldn't that, in effect, have undone or possibly have undone whatever Judge Parkins did?
I think it could have, but I think Judge Parkins' feeling was that a settlement is a settlement even though you have minors involved because you have apparent authority.
Well, happily, the law doesn't allow us to feel about these things.
I understand that, sir.
We have to follow the law.
I understand that.
So he would have been forced to make a decision, in other words, reach a conclusion based on the facts, that $7,500 to each of the minors was fair and reasonable to each of them in their own rights. If the facts are, and I only say if the facts are, that one of the minors only went to the emergency room and that's the only medical bill and there's no permanent injury of any kind, no scarring or anything else that would give rise to damages, how could anyone have reached the conclusion that dividing at $7,500 each is fair and reasonable?
Well, I guess what Judge Parkins opined was that why did we get in this situation in the first place? And I certainly never spoke to Mr. Amuno and advised him about my client's injuries or his client's injuries.
Well, since this jurisdiction has passed the Superior Court no longer plays any equitable role. If you simply, as lawyers, get your clients to agree that this is the settlement or purport to have the authority to represent that they've agreed that this is the settlement, that now ends the matter?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. And I do understand, as the court said, Judge Parkins did suggest that we file petitions with the commissioner, which is the way it's done now, and I did that. And Judge Parkins did not rule on allowing my petition for the minor settlement to approve. But what has occurred in the meantime, again, which I think is important, is that Mr. Romuno, the money was paid to the pathonitory, and Judge Parkins ordered that we remove it from the pathonitory, which we did. My money is still in an escrow account. Mr. Romuno dispersed his money to his client. It's obviously not in a guardianship account because there was no guardianship.
Well, that's a different issue entirely. The point here is, I think, on appeal, is should this case be remanded for the purpose of holding a hearing to determine whether the settlement as proposed by the parties is fair and reasonable with respect to each of the minor plaintiffs?
Well, I think that's one of the purposes of the minors law, and that's one of the reasons why.
Isn't that what should happen here?
I believe, well, Your Honor, again, my concern is that what happens now?
Let's put your concern on the show.
Yes, sir.
Answer my question. As a matter of law, isn't something that should have been done still not done, and our obligation is to remand it so it can be done?
Well, I think reading the law as the way it's written, you're correct. But
well, do I have an option other than to read the law as it's written?
No, sir. But again, to answer your question completely, if lawyers settle cases and they make a settlement, and then all of a sudden they get to the minor settlement stage and they argue that this wasn't fair, that wasn't fair, we're going to have, you know, you could have settlements that don't take place until you actually go through the minor settlement.
Yes.
Process.
But the theory is you don't have settlements take place until you have gone through the hearing to determine that because minors can't make decisions for themselves, that their guardian ad litem or whoever is representing them for the purpose of the minor settlement, who can act for them with the advice of counsel, has an opportunity to show whether the settlement's fair and reasonable.
Well, I think the court, the lower court was relying upon the apparent authority that an attorney has to bind a client, whether a minor or not, and whether or not that's right or wrong, Your Honor.
We're talking about two different things.
I understand.
Let's just assume the settlement's approved, but it involves a minor.
Yes, sir.
The second step is, to see if it's fair and settlement to the minor. And the reason you go through the other part of the process is because normally the minor's money is put in a guardianship account or something.
That's correct.
So that it's, you know, dispersed in the appropriate way.
And it's for the benefit of the minor.
So what we have here is arguably the approval of a settlement, but from the minor's point of view, the most important step has never occurred. First, no one decided it was fair to the minor, even though it was a binding settlement. Second, it was never put in a guardianship account.
I agree, Your Honor. That's why I left my money in escrow. But I do think that a invalid settlement, for the lack of a better term, can be ratified.
Well, putting that aside, why didn't you pursue this part of the case that's unresolved? It looks like we have an interlocutory appeal here.
Well, again, what I did was, after Judge Parkins made his decision on re-argument, I filed a petition to have a minor settlement, which is the old-fashioned way where you look at the medical records, and I was certainly anticipating the court to make a decision, either through the commissioner's office, to determine how much of that money my client would be entitled to.
Well, here's where we seem to be having a disconnect. The Superior Court said this is a binding settlement.
Yes, sir.
So we have an order on the record, binding settlement. Mr. Romano had authority to bind his client. The missing part of the equation is, was the settlement fair to the minor, even though it was a binding settlement?
I agree. And again, what I did was what I could do, which was file the petition for the minor settlement, which is what we did.
Well, if you agree, then on what legal basis are you defending the judgment of the court from which this appeal is taken?
That there is apparent authority to bind the settlement, and the settlement was entered into.
Okay, so you're saying it's a matter of law, if there's apparent authority to make the settlement binding, that trumps the independent legal requirement that there be a court determination of the fairness of the settlement, at least as far as the minors are concerned.
Well, I think that is...
Yes or no?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's a strong consideration. And in this particular case...
There's got to be more than a strong consideration.
I understand that, Your Honor. But if you take together the fact that I know the court has heard this already, if the money has been dispersed, how can we now go back and get a guardianship approval when, if Mr. Romano is right and he's entitled to $10,000, now that $7,500 that he's dispersed to his clients already out, how can additional money go in a guardianship account if he's already dispersed what was agreed upon?
He dispersed the money to a minor?
No, I believe it was dispersed to, I mean, he can speak to that himself, but I think there couldn't have been a guardianship account because the money, he dispersed it, and he said, I'm not going to get less than $7,500, and he wrote me a letter that said, I'm just going to disperse it.
Well, let's assume for a moment that he dispersed the money other than to a guardianship account. Let's not rule out the possibility that when he dispersed it, he dispersed it into an account that may be in the name of the minor's parent or parents, but for the benefit of the minor. We just don't know the answer to that. The record doesn't reflect that. If it's been improperly dispersed in some way, we know how to remedy that. But that's easy enough.
And I guess my point, Your Honor, is if you're arguing that Judge Parkins didn't do this right, I don't think it's fair to also argue I didn't do it right either and I dispersed the money. I mean, I think...
Your client's money is in escrow.
The alleged money that my client is entitled to is in escrow, sir.
Okay. That's not before us. That's not...
I understand that, Your Honor.
Our concern, I think it's fair to say, and I take some risk at making that plural, is that the minors, each of them, have gotten the fair shake that the law intends them to get, and that is an assessment by a dispassionate, objective magistrate, whether it be a commissioner with an order approved by a Superior Court judge or a Superior Court judge directly, that their attorneys and their guardians' proposed distribution is fair to each of them. Because when they turn 18 and they turn around and want to argue about it, you want to be able to show a record saying everything
was done properly. Every box was checked. You have nothing to complain about now.
Well, and I agree, and I think that's one of the reasons why the judge was struggling with the fact that Mr. Muno had agreed, and then after he agreed said, I really didn't have the authority to do it. But there were letters where he carbon copied his client and said, I was going to take 10.
I don't know why we're having such difficulty, an apparent inability to parse these two steps.
Well, I do understand the court's questions, and I respect the court's questions. I'm not carrying Judge Parkin's water. I'm trying to explain to the court why I think he ruled the way he did, and I think there is an issue because we could have interpled this money. We could have had an arbitration. We could have had a mediation. Could have had a hearing and said, let's divide this up. But there was an agreement. And so the court was struggling with the fact that there was an agreement. I understand that there is another step involved. The court asked that another step be done. We filed a petition. Mr. Romuno didn't, and then he dispersed the money. So is there a consequence to that? I'll leave it up to the court. But I think that's what this is a very unique case in that situation.
I certainly hope so.
Thank you. That's all I have, sir.
Mr. Romuno, I think we have another appellee who's asked for time before your rebuttal.
I'm sorry.
I think you'll want to hear from both of them before you
use
your rebuttal.
Yes, sir.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Rob Leone, representing Titan Indemnity Company. The main reason for me getting up to present argument to the court is there were some statements in the reply brief written by Mr. Romuno as to misrepresentations that I made to him regarding the injuries. We've spoken about this, and I completely disagree that I made any representations to him about injuries, let alone misrepresentations. My understanding was he was going to correct that before the court today or explained that he does not believe I did anything untoward, but I haven't heard that, so I wanted to make sure that that was clear on the record, because my name is important to me, and honestly, Titan came forward and did the right thing for its insureds and put up more money than the policy was there because they made a mistake, and we presented this to the parties. I did not have medical records to be able to make representations to Mr. Romuno regarding the injuries and how it should be split up. My letters are clear that I actually offered the money up on behalf of Titan and its insureds and suggested to them that they split it. There is no letter from me indicating there should be an even split or $7,500 split at all. It does not exist.
Do insurance carriers in today's world typically turn over the money to counsel before there has been a minor settlement hearing before a court which has to approve a proposed settlement?
Insurance carriers do not do that, Your Honor. And in this case, the money was turned over to the court through an interpleader action, which was specifically demanded by Mr. Romuno in a letter to me that we interplead the money into the court.
And what happened after that had nothing to do with any application on your part whatsoever?
No, sir. Not at all. No insurance company, let alone Titan Indemnity here, is going to pay any money to anybody unless the steps are followed. And in full open honesty and candor to the court, a court approval of these splitting of the money between these two minors did not occur. That was a step that usually does occur. And in fact, in candor, in my letters, it was a requirement each time.
But you put the full amount of money in the court, and to the extent the prestonatory dispersed it in two checks, that was the decision the prestonatory made based on whatever instructions they might have gotten from someone else.
Your Honor, the prestonatory issued the two checks upon order from Judge Parkins of the lower court, the quote-unquote final order that the court has been discussing so far.
It wasn't done as a consequence of any action taken by yourself or your client.
No, sir. The final order was issued, and Judge Parkins issued the order, directed the court to do that, and directed the prothonotary to do it and to enter judgment against the Titan insureds and to immediately satisfy those judgments. From Titan's standpoint, they've tried to do everything possible to protect their insureds, and we believe we did here, and that there is a dispute between the minor claimants as to how much of the $15,000 they should get. But at the end of the day, that is something to be resolved by the lower court and the claimants. And the cases should be finally dismissed at once all the proper steps have occurred.
Okay. Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Somewhat surprised by Mr. Leone's statement. First of all, I did not, I'm not saying that he intentionally misrepresented something to me. He based this on what Mr. Nietzsche told him, and that is what he told me. He's never told me anything differently. But I was also, frankly, surprised by his comment that I demanded that the money be placed in the proprietary's office, because I wrote him at least two letters, one that I have in front of me. It clearly says you should not deposit the funds and thereby lose control of them until the appeal is completed. And I went on to say, to protect your clients, you should not deposit the funds until the appeal is concluded. I said that in two letters. This is one of them. It's not on the record, of course. You know, so for him to say that I demanded that the money be deposited is, I mean, just contrary to the facts. But it's really, frankly, irrelevant. I just wanted the court to be aware that, I mean, that certainly didn't do that. Now, insofar as this argument that, well, I asked for $10,000 and the court looked at that, the court had no knowledge of that. The only thing that the court had when the decision was made the court didn't say authority was given. Did not make a finding of that. The court simply said authority is presumed, quote, period. Now, as I said in my reply brief, when the court made the decision on March the 2nd, it only had four or five items before it. They were part of the record already. First, it had the motion that Mr. Nietzsche filed to enforce the settlement. It had my response that is in the record already. It had also a letter that was part of the record. And it also had possibly another letter and, of course, the argument itself. That's all it had. All those things were in the record, and they're itemized in my opening brief, and I can cite to them if Your Honor wants to. But they're there. That's all the court had. They had none of this other stuff that Mr. Nietzsche put in, that both of them put in their exhibits. There were none of them were part of this record. There was three pieces of paper and the argument. That's all there was. And my main argument initially was, to Judge Perkins, was you don't have jurisdiction on my client because Judge Tolliver does. The only reason Mr. Nietzsche filed it there is because he improperly added my client as plaintiffs, even though, of course, there was no fee agreement. They represent them.
Mr. Herman, I want to ask you a procedural question. Mr. Nietzsche says that you disperse the money to your client, and we have cases that hold if you accept the benefit of a judgment, you cannot attack that judgment on appeal. So if your client accepted the money, the question would be, why can they attack a judgment on appeal when they've accepted the benefit of the judgment?
My client did not accept the money. My client received the money. The proprietary paid the money over to my client. The actual check was paid over to my client.
The minor?
Pardon me?
A minor?
No, Dawn Locke. That is the mother, the guardian.
Oh.
The proprietary actually paid the check to my client, Dawn Locke. My client had the check and, of course, came in and I said to my client that this should be, of course, in the deposit. He said, well, I need the money for braces for my daughter.
Well, did the check read Dawn Locke as guardian ad litem or from the personitary?
I don't think so. I think it's just that Dawn Locke, but I can't be positive, Your Honor. I didn't keep a copy of the check. I may have, but I'm sure we could get one. But the check was literally payable to my client, as I said.
Well, it says the judgment's entered in favor of her as a friend of Kimberly, next friend instead of guardian as Kimberly Froth. So I assume that's the way the check was made.
Your Honor could be correct. I just don't remember. But I mean, but I know that it was made payable to her, not to me, and
I
not to.
I understand. But if the guardian is taking this appeal, is that correct?
Of course.
And if the guardian's accepted the money, my question for you is, how do we deal with our cases that say, if you accept the money, you can't attack the judgment?
Because, Your Honor, what is it that you would have expected her to do? I mean, just simply, I mean, she said that she needed the money, the child needed the money for braces. If it had been placed in a account with Chancery Court, she could have gone to Chancery Court and asked that the money be used for braces. They would have said fine.
Well, maybe we're all confused, because at least the questions from the three of us indicate, if you're right, the $7,500 was never determined properly, so there should have been no money in any account anywhere. As I understand your position on appeal, you're entitled to more than $7,500. So
yes.
To that extent, you're rejecting the $7,500. So you can't reject the $7,500 and take an appeal and at the same time cash the check.
Yeah, there's a final order from Judge Parkins that makes it clear that the proprietor is to pay the money to them. Just because, I mean, there's two different things. One, if Your Honor has this policy, the court has this policy that Your Honor stated, fine, that's whatever the policy is. But if Your Honor is looking at contracts or looking at procedure, if someone owes you $10,000 and sends you $5, just because you put the $5 in your pocket doesn't mean that you're not entitled to the $10.
No, I think that's right. I think Justice Holland's point is it does mean you don't have the right to appeal, that you should get an additional $995. I think that's the point.
The way the cases normally come up is that Prothonotary enters the judgment for $10,000. Nobody has a check for anything yet. And the party appeals because they wanted more than $10,000. So the appeal is we should have gotten $25,000. But while the appeal's pending, the other side sends a check for $10,000. And if you take the $10,000 and cash it, the law is you can't still argue on appeal that you want $25,000 if there hasn't been a reservation of rights or something else.
Well, there was a reservation of rights because we appealed. I mean, the mere fact that we appealed was a reservation of right. I mean, and the fact that this is not the party saying, here, take 10 and forget about the appeal. This is the Prothonotary sending a check in accordance with a court order.
The functional equivalent of a reservation of rights might have been your own petition to the Superior Court to hold a minor settlement hearing. We heard that the other side did file such a petition. Did you?
Your Honor, I must have written 10 letters. I may be exaggerating. Maybe it was only 5, but... And I file a motion asking Judge Parkins to stay this. They're in there. Some of them are in there, some are not. I kept on saying, please stay this. I proposed an order, said, order the Prothonotary, dismiss the case, enter your judgment, because he wanted a final order, but order the Prothonotary to stay any distribution. I said that many, many times. Now, and I'm glad Your Honor mentioned the approval because, again, I was saying that there was no way that the court is going to reverse itself or the commission is going to reverse the court, and there is no way for the court to give my client more money if we're going to have separate petitions for approval because the issue is not, if Barlow says, fine, $75,000 is plenty for you. That's wonderful. Why should the court reject it? Then the money basically is already said. He has 75. There's only 75 left. So what else can the court do? Now, if the court remands it, by the way, which I hope you do, I would ask that you order that this fairness hearing be for both of them together. And the issue would be how to divide this 15, not if $7,500 is fair for Barlow. Because it's more than fair for him. I mean, it's too much. And if it's fair for Falk, because once you agree, once you say that he's there, then what do you do with Falk? So The fact is, I asked the court to stay numerous times.
You're out of time, and I think we take your point. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.
Thank you, Your Honor.